Hi, I'm KSL's Debbie Worthen. 4 years ago, my son Asher was diagnosed with autism. After getting our footing, we decided it was time to celebrate the news with all of you. And that's how Celebrating the Spectrum was born. Each week, we consult with the experts and others who are learning to navigate life with a loved one who has special needs. This is a place where we find hope, look for solutions, and connect with those working to create a better world of inclusion. I've known today's guest for 30 years. I actually met Candace Christiansen in high school, but I had the chance to work more with her in recent years on a lifestyle show that I hosted for years here in Salt Lake City. We never talked about autism on that show. We talked about sex because Candace is a well-known sex therapist here in Utah. Candace, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is fun. I noticed a few years ago on your social media accounts that you talked about getting diagnosed with autism. So, and I should go back. So Candace and I didn't know each other super well in high school. We went on a few double dates together, hung out a few times. And I think of it as we were kind of like fringe friends, like friend groups on the fringe that came together. But what I always liked about you was your genuine kindness. And you didn't play games. And that's, I think, rare for girls in high school. So, okay.
That
so
is.
When you were formally diagnosed with autism, tell us about that. That was when? A few years ago?
Going on 5 years now. And so, I had wondered for quite some time, but I, again, was in my 40s at the time. Now I'm almost 50. And so I was just asking the wrong people. And, you know, even though I was doing my own research, when you ask, you know, people will say, well, you give eye contact or you're in a relationship, you're not autistic. There's a lot of misassumptions about it. And so, after being misdiagnosed, I mean, I've been in therapy off and on since I was a teenager and finally found a really astute clinician that said, have you ever wondered if you're autistic? And I was like, oh my gosh, I finally feel like someone sees me and gets me.
So had you wondered that?
I wondered it for quite some time and my relationships were really struggling. My relationship with my now husband, Chris, was really, really struggling. And I actually think that my diagnosis really helped us a lot. I don't want to say it saved us because that puts it all on me and it's relationships are definitely a two-way street. But we were struggling so much with communication that, and I was struggling with communicating with my staff. I have an outpatient treatment center and even my clinicians, it was just hard to communicate with. I was having meltdowns and just really struggling. So I thought, I've got to figure out what's going on because I know I'm not borderline. Again, that's often a misdiagnosis that a lot of late diagnosed autistic women get.
And borderline what? Like borderline?
Borderline personality disorder.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay.
Borderline personality disorder. So I know, you know, those are like that, for instance, is a misdiagnosis that a lot of autistic women get. And a lot of autistic men get misdiagnosed as narcissistic.
And I can see
reality,
why. Yeah. Yeah. That would make sense.
When in reality, I'm not like a drama queen. I'm highly sensitive. And I, you know, there was just a lot going on. So once I was diagnosed, then the light went on for Chris and I. It was like, okay, now we know what we can work with. And now I've just spent the last close to 5 years really becoming an advocate for other autistic adults to make sure that we're seen, known, heard, and understood for who we are instead of continuing to be misunderstood.
No, that's great. And when we first started talking about doing this podcast together, you talked about the subject of difference versus deficit. And we've had a couple of guests talk about that, not in that clear of terminology, but really even the idea. We had the dating coach from Love on the Spectrum come on. And similar to you, she was diagnosed, I mean, like 10 years ago, and she's, you know, 50 years old. And she said, oh, what a difference it would make if we could just stop calling it a disorder and call it a difference. She's like, this, the kindness that that would bring to everyone involved. So, and women are harder to diagnose. We've learned that. And girls are harder
women
to diagnose.
And girls.
Yeah. And so when you look back to your teen years, to, you know, those formative years, what difference would that have made for you had you known? I mean, you know, 35 years ago, Was there a stigma to getting that diagnosis?
Oh, yes.
Do you feel like there still is?
I don't think there's as much of a stigma. I think there's definitely more understanding now, but I grew up in the 70s and 80s like you did.
Yeah.
So I can't even imagine. Autistic research was being done on boys. I mean, girls just weren't even considered. And so back then, I don't even know. I do know all of my pictures show me stimming in some way, you know, whether I'm swinging my arms or, you know, I sucked a binky till I was five. I mean, I had serious meltdowns. I was seeking soothing. I was trying to soothe in an environment that was too much for me. But as I grew up, you know, you start to watch and go, oh, this is how I'm supposed to act or talk, or even though I didn't feel, quote, normal. What is normal, by the way?
Yeah, there's no normal. Right.
There's no normal. But so, yeah, I think if my parents had known, if I don't think I actually would have been accurately diagnosed, but let's say it was like now back then, I do think my support needs, like, the fact that I was so anxious in my sensory environment and it would cause me to have meltdowns, significant, aggressive. I was very aggressive as a kid. That would have helped.
Right. Well,
that would help me a ton.
Yeah. I look at it also from the perspective of when our son got his diagnosis, it's the first diagnosis really in my family with my kids and my extended family with my siblings. Mm-hmm. And so it's just all been new. But what that diagnosis did for us as an extended family was, okay, we need to shift how we approach this. And so instead of my family just feeling like your kid is out of control, you know, it's like, this his brain is not working the way ours works. And so let's figure out how we can accommodate and make everyone happy. And it has been really, really heartwarming to watch that and to watch my family really rally around this little boy who, you know, I'm so glad we're with him. We've learned so much. And I'm glad that it's this era because, you know, 35, 40 years ago, the books I've read, it's just like, this is so crazy. And you can see why adults who are autistic are so against some of the therapy that was happening back then and some of the terminology and some of the things that doctors were telling families when they were giving them that diagnosis of your child is autistic. This is the worst possible news we could ever give you. You know, where my extended family is more like, you know what? I bet every successful CEO is on the spectrum. You know, they're saying stuff like that because of the extreme interest. Okay. So let's talk about girls for a second, because I've read research that shows that girls who are autistic are statistically in more dating violence relationships, you know, unhealthy relationships with their partners. Why are girls so hard to identify as autistic?
Well, I think historically, because the research has been about boys who are autistic. And when you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. We each actually demonstrate our traits differently. And girls versus boys tend to, quote, fit in. You know, the things that we might do, like as I'm quietly stacking my Barbie dolls and lining up my toys, because I'm quiet and I look compliant, no one's looking at how everything has to be lined up for me.
So maybe it would have been obvious if they would have been looking at a boy doing that.
Exactly. But for me, like when I look back, I had very kind of rigid mannerisms and play. It was very, very linear. Like if it was a boy, they might be, oh, okay. And the meltdowns, you know, again, that would fit in more historically with like the Asperger's, you know, we don't use that diagnosis anymore, but meltdowns that I was having, again, if a boy was having, they might look at that more, you know, just all the struggles with like really struggling with so much in my environment. If I was a boy, that would have likely, if it was my brother, I have a twin brother.
You know? I didn't know that. Okay.
Perhaps. Yeah. And so perhaps, you know, he would have been diagnosed quicker than me. So I do think there's a lot of stereotypes and assumptions about what boys and girls look like who are autistic. And we're breaking the stereotypes because autism doesn't look a certain way.
Right.
It doesn't look a certain way.
Well, and the spectrum is so broad, which is so fascinating. I mean, you know, we got Asher's diagnosis a few years ago. I've been taking a deep dive, literally calling everyone I know who knows someone who, you know, how this goes.
I love it.
Because I want to know everything that I need to know. And I'm also fully aware I don't know what I don't know. And so that's one reason this podcast has been really, really great for me. All right. So you call yourself an Aspie woman. Do you still use that term?
I don't. I've evolved, and partly because I've learned more about Hans Asperger and what he did in Nazi Germany with the Nazis. And I'm really against that, you know? And so again, if we talk about different, not deficient, I don't anymore. If I'm talking about it with folks in terms of, you know, how my traits might present, I would say, yeah, the way that Asperger's used to be categorized, or, you know, in the DSM, for instance, perhaps that would fit more of me. And I say I'm autistic. I mean, I definitely have support needs that people don't see when I'm at work or on a podcast. But if you come home with me and you ask Chris, I do have support needs.
So, okay. All right. So we have talked to several adults who were diagnosed in adulthood, and they talk about that moment, you know, and one is Jared Stewart, and he's an amazing guy. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he talks about that day because he had self-diagnosed. He was very educated like you are in this, in this field. And he was working with autistic adults, and it was just like, he knew. But then when the doctor said, yes, you know, you are autistic, it was very, very emotional for him. Did you have that same kind of experience?
Yes. There were things that I would do. For instance, Chris and I would be at a grocery store, and I would be in someone's personal space in the line, and he'd have to pull me back. I just, no spatial awareness, Debbie, you know, or like sitting there and I'd be chewing gum with my mouth open, like just not, you know, just not aware. And it's not, I'm not saying that I'm very different focused, diversity focused, not deficit, but to get to where you're going, you know, what is going on with me? There were those things. And then melting down at things, I mean, severe meltdowns with Chris, where it was like, okay, what is happening? Like, this is not a situation where I should be having such a strong emotional reaction, you know? And then staff saying you're unprofessional, because again, I was very like finding that things would cause me to react really strongly, not being aware of my sensory sensitivities or my environment. Those things, you know, I started doing research, like you said, Jared did, but I was doing it for a while and asking my therapist friends who were not autism specialists, who would again say, oh no, you're giving eye contact, you're not. So I questioned myself, but again, I had this feeling like I know I am. Every time I was taking an assessment online, it fit.
Right.
So it was very emotional and very reassuring for me. It was very reassuring. And then I also went through kind of a grieving process, which I think a lot of autistic adults do, where it's like, well, what would this have meant if I was diagnosed sooner? And what does this label mean for me? I was very scared at first to make it public, you know, and Debbie, I went on another station and they had asked me to come on, and I was going to talk about mindfulness. And I said, hey, you know, I actually shared I was autistic. The whole interview changed to me being autistic. And that was traumatic for me. Mm-hmm. And then they never invited me back on. So there was this experience of, is something wrong with me because I've owned that this is who I am? There's also some of that in a world that still does have a lot of microaggressions against autistic people and stigma and stereotypes. So it's been a roller coaster.
I love that you put it out there, because when we first had Asher's diagnosis, we were just like, this is just our family thing, you know, and we're not going to be loud and proud about it. And then I really had a huge pivot, because I was just like, if I want true inclusion, which that's my long-term mission, that's no secret. That's part of the description of the podcast. You know, I want true inclusion. It means being out there, being open, letting Asher be his true self, live his authentic life publicly around people, not stopping him. I mean, obviously, if he's like really, you know, tearing a place apart, or, you know, someone can't enjoy a football game because he's, you know, like just being a little too crazy, then I'll step in at that time. But I want this to be the norm. I want us to live in a new world where there's not the stigma. This is diversity. And I mean, come on, everyone talks about the value of diversity all the time. Mm-hmm. Well, let's take it here too, you know? So, but I'm sure that was very hard for you because your identity, I'm guessing, had been highly associated with your professional success as a therapist.
Mm-hmm. As a therapist and also someone who was on the, in the media a lot.
Right.
I mean, I was on with you a lot, you know, and so it's scary. I also learned to like watch how people would talk and mannerisms and how to dress. And it, that's all masking. Mm-hmm. And I call it traumatic masking now because it's really it's traumatic for those of us that have to try and fit in by camouflaging who we are. It's exhausting.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. I mean, I can't even imagine that. Okay, so your podcast, let's talk about your podcast. It's called Fabulously Candace, the sexiest podcast about neurodivergence. So I listened to the first episode, loved it. Talk about what you discuss on your podcast and why you decided to do it.
Well, it's definitely been an evolution. Chris and I actually started it together. And then with our business, I, you know, went on my own and I changed the name at the first of the year. I want to give credit to Jude Morrow, he's in the United Kingdom and he has Neurodiversity Gold podcast. And he said, just in this beautiful accent of his, you should actually name your podcast Fabulously Candace, the sexiest podcast about neurodivergence, because no one is really talking about intimacy and autism at that level. And so I was scared to do that, kind of change, you know, mid-stride, whatever, but I did. And it's been really fun. We talk to autistic individuals, mixed neurotype couples, you know, professionals about autism and sex, relationships, intimacy, communication, you know, like challenging issues in relationship, problematic sexual behavior, you name it, we talk about it, we go there.
So as far as relationships go, how have relationships evolved for you? You know, from teenage years to young adult to now, like, you know, being a successful adult, I'd say that a successful adult, an emotionally successful adult. How has that changed? And looking back, do you feel like you fit into that group of women who got into some of those situations? And now you can look back and say that probably was partly due to this part of me.
Yeah, I mean, I would, even though I was cautious about drinking, I've always been cautious about drinking. I grew up with an alcoholic mother, so I've always just been really cautious about drinking alcohol, for instance. But there's research that shows a lot of autistic people will get involved in substances. And I think a part of that is masking to fit in. So with friend groups, I would just try to, how can I fit in? It was always really hard. I could have one friend, but if it got to more than one, I didn't know how to navigate that. I couldn't keep up. And I also would really anger a lot of my friends starting in, elementary school, but I can think of so many embarrassing times, junior high and high school, Debbie, oh my gosh, where I just, I've had to do my own personal amends with my higher power about it because I would just have meltdowns or I would make them angry because I would insult them. And I would say things that were, I'd be upset. And instead of handling it the way that you're quote supposed to, my emotions would get the best of me and I would melt down. And so since my diagnosis, so many people are compassionate and kind and loving, and I've actually been able to develop some really beautiful, authentic friendships. I don't have a lot of friends. I'm not going to say like I have a big friend group. I don't. It's Chris and I against the world pretty much.
But do most people have a lot of friends? I just wonder that. I mean, I feel like I'm friendly, but I have like a handful. That's it, of like truly close confidants.
Yeah, some people like that. But for us, I think, and I'm so grateful that Chris is like this, we just love our time. Mm-hmm. And I'm thankful for that because if I was with, in my previous marriage, I was with someone who was a social butterfly. Mm. And I do know other autistic folks who love being social, and I'm just not one.
Right.
I, you know, especially if there's topics that I just don't relate to at all whatsoever, it's boring to me. I don't like small talk. I want deep conversation. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't like that. So, but as I've gotten older, I have developed some really beautiful, authentic friendships. I don't have a lot, but but they're really worthwhile now and very accepting. I haven't changed when you said, you know, you like that I was kind and I just didn't play games. Mm-hmm. I still don't play games. Right. And I think that's what my closest, dearest friends love about me is that I am. I'm just authentic, real and kind and loving. And I'm here. I'm loyal.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. No, I love that. And friendships with adults, it's a whole different thing because, you know, we have those couple where, I mean, I have a couple college roommates. I don't talk to them for several years and you just pick mm-hmm. right back up, you know, but overall, yeah. I mean, I think people are always surprised when they hear I'm actually not that social because yeah. I come across as being very social, but yeah. the reality is that can be very exhausting for me.
You know? I bet.
Yeah, my favorite mm-hmm. place is probably just chilling in my bedroom at home. So, okay, mm-hmm. Candace, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about intimacy and we'll say neurodiverse relationships. Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll be right back. We are with Candace Christiansen, a well-known sex therapist here in Utah, who was recently identified as autistic about 5 years ago. I went to high school with Candace, went on a couple dates with Candace and our boyfriends at the time, hung out a few times. And it's so fascinating to me, these adult diagnoses that we're seeing, because I think we're going to see a lot more of them. Do you?
I agree. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And we have this family friend who, she's divorced now, and we just all thought her ex-husband was just such a weirdo. And he was recently diagnosed as autistic. And I feel so bad. Like, I feel like all of us would have approached the whole thing differently had we known that, you know, and not in a pity way, just in an understanding way. And I'm looking at autism, you know, I'm a mom of an autistic kid. I'm looking at it through a different lens now. So what I'm noticing is there are not a lot, but several people in my life who I am like 99% sure on the spectrum. Yeah. Have you started seeing that with people that you know as well?
Oh, I've seen it. I've seen it for a long, long time. So I agree with you. And I would say now in our outpatient center, we treat 100% neurodivergent folks. So whether they're genetically neurodivergent or environmentally neurodivergent, mm-hmm. that's a whole other topic for a whole other day. But yeah.
Right. What's given me a lot of hope is because, you know, when you get that diagnosis for your child, it's very scary. You're like, what does the future hold? I need to shift my thinking. And bottom line is parenting is all about shifting your thinking expectations all the time. Mm-hmm. But you just wonder, like, what does their life hold? And so for me, it's given me a lot of hope, even talking to you where, oh, you have lived a great, full, happy life. Mm-hmm. And it's what I could hope for my son, you know, especially mm-hmm. with this world of inclusion that I hope that we're really embracing as society. Okay, let's get into some of the nitty gritty. So when you talk about intimacy with autistic adults, and I'm guessing in most cases it's one's autistic, the other is not. Is that accurate or is that not accurate?
You know, I don't know that that's accurate.
Or is that irrelevant?
I actually think, you know, I think I see a lot of folks, Debbie, that will come to me saying they're in a mixed neurotype relationship when I see neurodivergence in both of them. Mm. I do think like attracts like.
Yes. Well, yeah, your vibe attracts mm-hmm. your vibe attracts
yeah.
your tribe.
Yes, yeah. I love that.
And mm-hmm. when you were talking about you're still the mm-hmm. same, you're still the same kind person that doesn't play games and that. Mm-hmm. I thought, yeah, and mm-hmm. you can see that. Every time I've talked to you, even in our adult mm-hmm. life, I get that impression from you. You live an authentic life for you, and that is a beautiful thing. Okay, so what are the issues that those couples are facing?
Well, I just want to say to listeners mm-hmm. that all relationships have issues. Two people bring in issues that they're going to struggle with. And so, and autistic people and non-autistic people speak different languages. Mm-hmm. So there's this misassumption about autistic people lack empathy. And now there's been research done called the double empathy problem, which mm-hmm. shows that if I'm autistic and you're autistic, Debbie, we understand each other.
Oh yeah. I've heard this research.
And
fascinating.
When we communicate, mm-hmm. if you and I were in a relationship where we're both autistic, we would get each other. Our communication would actually fly pretty easily. But if I'm with someone who's not autistic, Chris, our communication is going to be more challenging. What does that mean? That means The focus doesn't mean that I don't have empathy. The focus gets to be on he and I learning to understand each other and our perspectives. So that's a lot of the challenge that can happen in mixed neurotype relationships, where it does feel like you're talking in different languages sometimes. So practicing that patience mm-hmm. and really seeking to understand each other and demonstrating empathy towards each other is crucial. I have a lot of empathy. I'm a therapist, for goodness sake. Mm-hmm. I demonstrate empathy. I have a lot of emotion. And with my non-autistic, you know, people around me, including Chris, it can be hard to understand his perspective sometimes, just as he struggles with mine. So that's a big one. Mm-hmm. I will say that's a big one that I work with couples on, is how can you really listen to understand each other and hear? And also, how can we avoid making the autistic person in the relationship the quote project to fix? Mm.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Okay. So mm-hmm. yeah, along those lines, this researcher we had come on, he wrote the book Uniquely Human. Have you read that book?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-uh. Oh, it's amazing. You should read it. He's studied autism for 50 years and, you know, talks about the evolution of research and studying
that's great.
And he talks about that, where when observers watch two autistic people, you can't tell which one is autistic. And then, you know, and then when you mm-hmm. when you mix it up, then you can see there's a disconnect in the communication. So that's really interesting you say that. I also kind of laughed when you said people will come in and like, my significant other is the problem. You know, or it's like, actually, well, you're right. We're all dealing with issues. And when you're talking about, you know, coming, trying to understand each other and that type of thing, that sounds just like my marriage. Yeah, that sounds no mm-hmm. different. So is it just we're all trying to understand each other's perspective, or is it heightened? Is there a difference?
There is a difference in terms of, for instance, you know, it's challenging because I have a lot of sensory sensitivities, and so I can be okay to a point. So we could be at the mall, and if I'm don't have my noise canceling earbuds in, and you know, then all of a sudden it's too much and I'm at risk for having a meltdown. So it's like, and I don't want Chris to feel like I'm hijacking the day. Mm-hmm. So we've had to come up with agreements about, you know, if we're in a public setting or we're at a concert or whatever, and it's too much for me, can we drive separate cars? Can we have an agreement? Can we, so that you don't feel like I'm ending the night too soon, for instance, because I'm on overload. Mm-hmm. You know, we were at the airport getting back. We went to Maui recently and it took 12 hours to get back. And I'll tell you what, lack of sleep and the sensory overload for me, I was really pretty tapped. Mm-hmm. But for him, he wasn't. He was tired, but not tapped in the same way. Mm-hmm. And so we've really had to come up with agreements around, if I'm feeling that way, what can I do to self-care? Because in the beginning of our relationship, and especially right at the beginning of the diagnosis, that period, Chris moved into caregiver mode and he saw me as a project.
Mm-hmm. And that can't feel good.
No, it wasn't good. Mm-hmm. And so he realized, no, this is about the two of us working together. You know, he doesn't have to step in, but he can say, how can I support you? And it's like, I've got my earbuds, mm-hmm. you know, or whatever I can put in my noise canceling or my weighted blanket, so that he doesn't feel like he's tending to a child's needs.
Right.
You know, so in that sense, I do see that sometimes with mixed neurotype couples where one steps into more caregiver role and feels like their needs have to be pushed aside because they're trying to navigate the sensory sensitivities of what's going on. When in reality, if both people can be responsible for taking care of themselves, mm-hmm. it does work better. And that does sound like any kind of relationship, any coupleship.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about meltdowns. So I'm sure when you were a little kid, those meltdowns were like literal kicking and screaming, crying, right?
Oh, and attacking my siblings. I mean, my sister has scars because I would just attack. I was vicious, Debbie.
So,
but I would also go under my bed and headbang. I mean,
oh,
I would
yeah.
get
okay.
so
sucker.
Upset
okay,
that
yes.
I would be headbanging and I would be, I mean, just, I was inconsolable. I was so just literally, I mean, for hours.
So your parents, what were their thoughts on all of that?
Well, on so my mom's passed.
I'm sorry. I think I knew that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, you're okay. My dad, I was very nervous. You mean in terms of talking about me, my autism?
Well, yeah. I mean, like, how did they think when you were a little kid that they think like there's something different about Candace? Like,
no.
Okay.
No, I mean, I grew up in an alcoholic system, family system. So dad was military, and mm-hmm. when dad wasn't around, mom would drink. And so I honestly think they thought I got labeled as drama queen, oversensitive, worry wart. I was teased really bad by my siblings.
Oh my gosh, that's awful. But you know, some of these family dynamics, though, that's how families are. Mm-hmm. I mean, siblings aren't nice to each other.
Yeah. And I hear that with other autistic females too, that as kids, we get labeled as being, you're overly emotional. Then we grow up and it's like, you're too dramatic. I remember having a therapist say that to me. One of my own therapists said mm-hmm. to me, like, you're just addicted to drama. And it was like, once I was diagnosed, it's like, I'm highly sensitive. That doesn't mean I'm addicted to drama.
Yeah.
I live in a culture that is not neurosensitive or neuroinclusive. Mm-hmm. Like, it's too much for me. I'm going to be sensitive. It doesn't mean I'm dramatic. So that's how my family dealt with it.
Okay. Okay. And so as an adult, so you talk about when you and Chris were first together and mm-hmm. you would have a meltdown. What would trigger a meltdown? What does a meltdown for an autistic adult look like?
For me,
for you,
it can look mm-hmm. different for folks, but for me, it was short, abrupt, abrasive, you know, just like sometimes I might pound the table, or what would trigger it would be a change in the situation, a change in the schedule, feeling surprised, something that mm-hmm. came into my environment that I didn't expect.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I would be masking as a therapist all day.
Oh yeah.
And, mm-hmm. and then I would get home and I was exhausted, hungry, tired.
I was going to say, it was like the worst case scenario.
Oh, the worst. Yeah. And Debbie, when you used to interview me on TV, I would cry after every interview.
Oh, that makes me feel so bad.
I couldn't figure out why until I was diagnosed. And I was like, it's because I was in such a hyper aroused state mm-hmm. of masking and holding it together for those 4 minutes mm-hmm. that then I would leave and I would literally just burst into tears.
Yeah, it's an emotional release.
Now I know why.
Wow, that is so fascinating. All right, so for listeners who are thinking like, you know, this kind of describes my relationship or this kind of describes how I'm feeling, what are the solutions?
That's so loaded. Well, you know, I mean, I think people can, the solution would be get some support from, you know, a therapist or program that understands what you need. Luckily, there's a lot of neuroinclusive, neurosensitive books coming out mm-hmm. and therapists out there. And I will say, you know, for those of you that struggle with communication issues and connecting, I have found, and Chris has found as well, the Gottman books and the Gottman workbooks actually are really helpful. Why? Because I my brain works in concrete systemic, like a systematic way. Mm-hmm. And the Gottman's writing is very concrete. It spells out a script. I love scripts. Mm-hmm. Scripts help me so much in my relationship. That can be really helpful. That can be a good solution.
That is fascinating. No, that's great.
It is fascinating. Yeah. I wish I could say, let the Gottmans know, like, thank you. You really just nailed it without realizing that you're speaking in a neuro-inclusive way to so many of us autistic folks, because it just is really concrete. It's mm-hmm. a script. And I need a script. And when Chris and I struggle in any relationship, when you struggle, you know, our heart rate gets to a certain point, we can't hear, and then we're flooded. Mm-hmm. Getting out the Gottman workbook to go through an issue is incredibly calming to both of our systems and helpful. So, you know, the solution, I would encourage folks, get some counseling, get some coaching. We do neuro-inclusive counseling and coaching for folks. Get some support. There's podcasts like this one and ours. There's so many books coming out. There's so many great things. My dear colleague Mona Love does Neurodiverse Love, a podcast actually for partners. Mm-hmm. neurodifferent couples. Yeah.
That's great.
So there's just a lot of support out there now if you're wondering, you know, is this me? And you're curious. And I'll say some people want a formal diagnosis and some people don't need one.
I can see that.
Because if the label isn't going to, if you don't need a formal label for anything, but you do want to understand yourself better, go these other routes.
Right.
Right. You know? That's controversial.
But the label, I mean, what does it really do? Doesn't change you. Literally changes nothing other than if you feel like you need it and it clarifies life and sends you in a certain direction. Right. Then that's a fantastic thing. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
But even as you're talking about the communication, I think like my husband and I struggle big time when it comes to communicating, you know, and I always think like, I'm a professionally trained communicator, you know, so just say what you mean, that type of thing. But it's, you know, it's two people. Like you said, it's just always two people.
It's two people, and it takes practice. And we both have a history. You know, we have our genetics, how our brains work, and then we come from a family. You know, if you come from a family that didn't communicate, no one's a good communicator. I like to say that. And I am an exceptionally awesome autistic communicator. I do communicate very well. And Chris, he's very nuanced, and that is very challenging for me because I just want him to give it to me straight. Just tell me what is on your mind. Don't mince words. And so that's been a process.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And the nuance, I mean, from everyone that I've talked to on this podcast, the nuance is where the challenges lie a lot of times. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Someone in the ethers created these social norms about how we're supposed to communicate. And for those of us that are autistic and ADD, ADHD, and some other types of neurodivergence, it just doesn't work for us. And so I would love to have the world be more neurosensitive and inclusive instead of trying to force us to move into the neuromajority's way of communicating. Let's have it go both ways. Let's understand each other because the nuanced way to communicate is not the best way to communicate.
Agreed. Yeah. And I feel like I'm like you in the sense of just tell me, you're not going to hurt my feelings. Yeah. Like, just say the words. Yeah. Let's get this out. You don't need to mince words. Like just say it, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. So do you also work with couples who are neurotypical?
I'm sure we have. It's so funny, Debbie, because I would love to say, why, yes, we do. But I don't know anymore. I'll be honest.
Really?
I don't know anymore. I don't. I mean, I've actually said on listservs, we work with, you know, 100% neurodifferent folks because it's so hard to know what's typical. Mm-hmm. You know what? I feel like it is. And I say that, and I'm not saying that to say, by any means, everyone's a little autistic. That is a microaggression. Mm-hmm. That is not what I'm saying. But I am saying trauma creates an environmental neuro difference in the brain. Trauma, substance abuse, chronic substance abuse changes the way the brain works. So when we're working with domestic violence survivors, we're working with complex trauma survivors who, you know, are people who have chronic substance abuse issues, who've struggled with all kinds of addiction issues. That's why I'm saying environmentally, their brains have changed. So at this point, I don't know.
Yeah.
If we're talking about autistic, you know, ADD, ADHD folks, our bipolar clients, our schizophrenic clients, yeah, we've got genetic neurodifferent clients too, but I honestly don't know anymore what's typical. We all survived a pandemic, for goodness sake. Mm-hmm. Like we're changed for our brains and our autonomic nervous systems are changed forever. So
yeah, no, that's fascinating. When we were getting licensed to be foster parents, one of the classes was on trauma and how trauma and the brain aren't separate. They're interweaved. You know, you can't survive trauma. And it's like, oh, that trauma is sectioned off, you know, like we just cut that off. It's all interweaved. And what was so fascinating to me is how every person processes it so differently. Mm-hmm. You know, did you ever see the movie Lion? It had Nicole Kidman in it. And she and her husband, it's not a true story. She and her husband adopted these two boys from India. And they were not biological brothers, but one of them got to them and just little gem, angel child. And the movie is talking about he's going back to find his mom where she is, because it shows how he got separated from the family. And then the other child gets off the plane. They get home. He immediately starts like bashing his head into the TV, and, you know, just like so different. And it's like they both had experienced trauma that we don't even know the extent of. But those brains processed it so much differently, you know.
100%.
Yeah. So that's interesting. OK, any final thoughts you'd like to add?
I'm just sending so much compassion and love to everyone out there that is neurodifferent or in a mixed neurotype relationship or the parent of neurodifferent children, because we all need that. We need so much more understanding in a world that historically has been quite judgmental and unkind. And so I always end my podcast by saying that. And I just want to say that here too, that we all could use a little more kindness and understanding and neuro inclusion. And so that's what I want to end with.
No, I love that. Thank you. And that is so true in general. You know, the world needs more of that. And especially right now, don't you agree? I mean, everything is so, like, everything is divisive. I like the color blue. You like the color red. It's divisive. You know, I didn't choose those for political reasons either. I'm just saying it's like everyone wants to fight over everything, where we're all so much more alike than we are different.
We are. Yeah. We are. I love that. Yeah. Let's honor and embrace our similarities and our differences.
Candace, it was great talking to you today. I have always, you know, I've always loved talking to you. I've always just thought you're such a genuine person, and it's great to have your insight. So we'd love to have you back on the show sometime.
I love it.
Okay. Thank you so much. And Celebrating the Spectrum is a KSL podcast.